Amen. Awesome. Thanks, Mac. Okay. Yesterday, we began by talking about three levels of interpretation. What are they? Look at your notes. What is it? When it was first said, right? I don't know why you're apologizing, but you're fine. First said, what's second? First received. Absolutely. So your original readers, I before E, except after C. Okay. First received. Then what do we have? You're modern, and that word is used relative because I'm also speaking of the modern reading of it in the 11th century. So you have these three levels. What are we primarily looking at in this Messianic Expectation lecture series? The first one. When was it first said? What were they seeing? What were they engaging? What was being said? We're really kind of vacillating between these two on some level, but primarily this, okay, is what I'm wanting to hammer on. But we are engaging this, so I don't want to act as if we're not, okay? So we have pre-exilic texts, or actually pre-Jewish monarchy texts, that more retrospective, although very sparse in number, refer to some sort of messianic something. Then you have the Jewish monarchy where you start to see an increase of retrospective messianic texts. This all sounding familiar? Okay, yes? Then once we get to the pre-exilic and the exilic period, what happens? An explosion. It spikes. It kind of bell curves right there where we have an explosion of both, I think, first and retrospective messianic texts, where they're expecting something, and at times they're looking at a figure. And I'm not saying that even in the first level they see it clearly, but you do see a spike. I mean, this is where you get your Isaiah 53. You see a spike in something, your Zechariah 9, a spike in something that is happening. Now, once we are, before I move to the next era, we started to kind of summarize, what is this Jewish expectation as we're wrestling with this intervention? The Jews expected, in the first century, a return of the exile whenever God intervenes, a defeat of the enemies, we talked about that yesterday, and the return of the reign of Yahweh at Zion, which is our Isaiah 33:22 text on the board. For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, it is he who will save us. The restoration of his sovereignty or of his reign. Or Isaiah 52:7, how beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, who say to Zion, your God reigns. You see what they're looking for? This restoration of Yahweh's reign, sovereignty on Zion or in Jerusalem. So if they're looking for God's intervention during the time of the exile, they're looking for four things. We've said three now. They're looking for the return of the exiles, the undoing, an exodus of sorts. They're looking for a defeat of the enemy. Again, an exodus of sorts. The return of reign and reign of Yahweh at Zion. And number four, actually, hold on. Intertestamental literature, I forgot about this one. They even are talking about it. So this is now we're kind of bleeding into the intertestamental time, or I don't want to say post-exilic because I don't think the exile ever ended, but after the return. In the time of their visitation, they will shine forth and will run like sparks through the stubble. They will govern nations and rule over peoples, and the Lord will reign over them forever. The return of Zion, or Yahweh to Zion. Then the fourth one we see, an exaltation of Israel. They are expecting Israel to be exalted above all other nations. So return of the exile, defeat of the enemies, return of the reign or the sovereignty of Yahweh at Zion. And the fourth one is the reign of God's people, the exaltation of the nation of Israel. These are their expectations. However, and this is something we talked about in the myths, it does not necessitate a Messiah to accomplish these. At times, it includes one when they are discussing it, but it doesn't necessitate it. What is necessary is God to intervene. That's what's necessary. And when God intervenes, however that may be, if he uses a Messiah, fine. If he doesn't, whatever. But when he intervenes, those four things must happen. Those four things must occur. Otherwise, he has not intervened. Now, why is that such an important point when we're in this class where we're looking at the Gospels? It did come through a Messiah from a certain perspective. Right? I think this explains Acts 2's roll call. Where we're on Pentecost, and all of a sudden Luke just starts saying, and guess who all was there? It's like you have the Parthians and the Medes, and he starts like listing all these names of all these countries. What's weird is some of them are they're as far as you can get in the empire, and some of them don't even exist anymore. Or he's referring back to people groups like the Medes, Elamites, that have been gone for hundreds of years. Why does he do that? Well, because there's actually, during this time, there's actual invocation of these in the last days concept that you will have the Elamites returning to the Lord. And I think what you see in Acts 2 is a return of the exiles. Because they're in Jerusalem, in Zion, with God reigning through a crucified Christ so that the true enemy is now dead. I think that's what Luke's trying to say. However, from the Jewish perspective, they're not okay with that explanation. No. Because Rome's still reigning. Defeat of the enemy. The exiles aren't here. The Yahweh can't say that he is reigning because the emperor is still in charge. Where's the exaltation of Israel? You see what they're looking for? They're looking for a 1 Samuel 8 restoration, and Christ had his eyes on something bigger. So yes, it does come through a Messiah in a certain perspective. But if you don't see that perspective, you could actually still come away saying Christ did not restore what it is they were looking for. Which is why this is where it gets even crazier for me. Why it is a little bit strange whenever Christians will talk about as if there still needs to be a return to the promised land of the nation of Israel. Because then, in some sense, what they're saying is that the exile has not ended. Because Israel doesn't own all of the West Bank. It doesn't own all of Judea. To which I would say, through Christ, even the definition of the expectations has been altered. But even Christians sometimes don't even accept that. Which is a little bit disconcerting. But that's a whole other class, kind of. Okay. If there was a Christ, so if a Messiah is involved in this restoration, there is a pretty clear pattern, although there are nuances and contrasts, but there's a clear pattern that emerges. If there is a Christ, the Christ will be a Davidic warrior king. If there is a Christ, you see, and frankly, the Old Testament, you see it in non-Qumran Judaism, you see it in Qumran itself, that whenever the Messiah, if there is a Messiah in this intervention, the Jews saw him as a Davidic warrior king. So let's look at some texts. Old Testament, Jeremiah 23:5. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king. See how there is a figure. Who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. But notice, he is Davidic. This king figure, so you have the kingship, very Davidic. Psalm 110 gets the warrior part pretty viciously. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. Let that sink in a moment. What is a footstool? Describe it to me. Don't make it complicated. What is a footstool? Yeah, it's like an ottoman, right? Where you're sitting down lounging and you just prop your feet up. The enemies are your ottoman. That's subjugation. You see that? The defeat of the subjugation of the enemy. Your enemies have now become a footstool for your feet. The Lord will extend your mighty scepter from Zion. Notice where the Lord is reigning. You will rule in the midst of your enemies. See that? Exaltation of Israel, subjugation of the enemies. Your troops will be willing on your day of battle. Arrayed in holy majesty from the womb of the dawn, you will receive the dew of your youth. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek.
The Lord is at your right hand. He will crush kings on the day of his wrath. Notice the figure, the pronoun. He will judge the nations, heaping up the dead and crushing the rulers of the whole earth. He will drink from a brook beside the way. Therefore, he will lift up his head. You hear the warrior king in this, the Davidic warrior king. Here's what's interesting. Number one quoted psalm in the entire New Testament. Psalm 110. I don't think that's an accident. Because this is really, in some sense, if I would have just read this, you could have seen, oh, that's the Jewish expectation. If there is a Messiah, all of the elements we're looking for are right there. And the New Testament quotes this all the time, saying, this is what Christ did. All the expectations that you had are fulfilled in Christ. We just choose not to accept it. Is this making sense? You see also this Davidic warrior king outside of the Old Testament, some more intertestamental literature. Psalms of Solomon, we'll actually reread this verse in a moment. But see, Lord, and raise up for them their king, Davidic warrior king, the son of David, to rule over your servant Israel in the time known to you, O God. And in which you keep reading. So, I don't even know why I do that. I should just delete that. God, so I'm starting right here, okay? Undergird him with the strength to destroy the unrighteous rulers, to purge Jerusalem from Gentiles who trample her to destruction, defeat of the enemies, so that the exiles can return. In wisdom and in righteousness, to drive out the sinners from their inheritance, the promised land. To smash the arrogance of sinners like a potter's jar, to shatter all their substance with an iron rod, to destroy the unlawful nations with the word of his mouth. At his warning, the nations will flee from his presence, and he will condemn sinners by the thoughts of their hearts. He will gather a holy people whom he will lead in righteousness. There will be no unrighteousness among them in his days, for all shall be holy, and their king shall be the Lord Messiah. If there is a Messiah, in the Old Testament, intertestamental literature, and we'll even see here in a minute in Qumran, there is a Davidic warrior king motif. That if there is a Messiah that is restoring Israel, it will include those four expectations, but as a Davidic warrior king. You seeing this? So let's look at Qumran. 4Q252 says, the scepter shall not depart from the tribe of Judah. Whenever Israel rules, there shall not fail to be a descendant of David upon the throne, this figure, this everlasting throne. For the ruler's staff is the covenant of kingship, and the clans of Israel are the divisions, until the Messiah of righteousness comes, the branch of David, Davidic king. Then you see in 1QM, so your war scroll, by the hand of your anointed ones, there is a debate over whether or not that is plural or singular. Which if it was singular, then you have a singular Messiah. If it's plural, then you have multiple. By the hand of your anointed ones, seers and things appointed, you have told us about the times of the wars of your hands in order that you may fight or glorify yourself among our enemies. So you don't just have a Davidic king like you hear in 4Q 252, but you have a warrior motif, a battling motif. Enemies, blood flowing. This is what you're expecting from God's intervention. Now, if this, and so if I'm looking at Essenes, if I'm looking at, well, Psalms of Solomon, some people argue that's a Pharisee document, although it's hard to prove, all the way back to the Old Testament. If this is what is very clear, and Jesus comes along saying, hey, I am the Messiah. You know, the Matthew 16. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And what does Jesus say? Darn right, Peter. I'm not even going to call you Simon anymore. It's Peter. Because on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Then what does Peter get upset with Jesus about? Crucifixion. Jesus says, and I must die. And Peter's like, no. And frankly, Peter could have pointed to any number of texts. No. You're the Messiah. So if you're the Messiah, it's time for heads to start rolling. Matter of fact, it says he harshly rebukes Jesus. And then just a moment later, Jesus harshly rebukes Peter, saying, get behind me, Satan. Why? You're tempting me to engage the enemy that's actually not the true enemy. See what he's doing? It's not a shock for Peter to miss this. It's not a shock for Judas to miss this. It's not a shock, frankly, for the Pharisees and Sadducees to miss this. Because if you are the king, if you are the Messiah, you have a role to play. Jesus is Davidic. He claims a kingship. And yet, he's before Pilate and he says, "But my kingdom's not of this world. Therefore, I don't fight like the world." This is what makes Gethsemane so weird for the disciples, so strange. I mean, picture that moment where the Roman soldiers are coming up, and you're not Judas, you're one of the disciples behind Jesus going, "It's time." This is why I think John Mark's there. John Mark, Mark 15, you know, the one that they grab the clothing of, this one that runs away naked. Why do I think he's there? It's because I think he's saying, revolution's going to begin. I'm going to track these people until it launches. And whenever it does, I think he jumps out to engage with what Peter does by cutting off the ear. And then all of a sudden, Jesus is like, "Put your sword away." And John Mark's like, "Nobody even knew I was here. I want to leave." They try to grab a hold of him, and he takes off running naked. It's the convolution of that moment has a lot to do with what's happened before. What's their expectations? If there is a Messiah, he's not just Davidic, he's not just kingly, he is a warrior that is going to, as Psalms of Solomon says, to smash the arrogance of the sinners like a potter's jar, to shatter their substance with an iron rod, to destroy the unlawful nations with the word of his mouth, to devour them completely. But Jesus reveals there's an enemy that's greater than the enemies we've isolated. Is this making sense? The tension felt in the Gospels is not unfounded. It makes a lot of sense. And frankly, had I been saturated in texts like this from a very young age, I probably would have assumed the same thing. Like, we do this with expectations now, by the way. They're just more saturated in our culture. So things start, you know, people start getting sick around you, maybe even dying. You start struggling in school. Your ministry is struggling. And what do? "Where are you, God?" Well, why do you assume that God has abandoned you because bad things are happening to you? It's because in our culture, we have this latent health and wealth gospel that says if you follow God, everything is fine. That's your expectation. And when it isn't, you either think, "Am I doing something wrong? Am I not praying enough? Or am I not praying right?" Which is ludicrous. Or you start saying, "Well, if I'm doing everything right, then it's you." Or there's an enemy. And the way we destroy him is by embracing deserts and through our suffering proving to be victorious. We have our expectations shattered too. Just manifests itself a little bit different. But you have a Gethsemane. You have a situation where people approach and you think it's going to turn out one way and it turns out the exact opposite in a way that actually to you seems like loss and failure. Right? But I mean, at least on some level, when we come to the Gospels, we should see that their expectation that's being broken, 2,000 years looking back, seems like, how could you miss this? But looking at the 2,000 years before, looking forward, you would say, how could they have ever seen this? It's different. Messianic thought in the Jewish time after the exile, although you understand all my caveats because of the history. So the literature, kind of the intertestamental. So I'm looking more pseudepigraphical, apocryphal, as well as Qumran. Even after the exile, you still have the Jewish. This is part of the reason why I don't think that they believe the exile ever ended. Because you have this Jewish longing, this eschatological longing for liberation that does not wane even when their situation changes. Even when they're allowed to return and start rebuilding the temple. You still see this zeal for wanting Yahweh to return. You see it in Testament of Moses 10, 1 through 10. "Then his kingdom will appear throughout his whole creation. Then the devil will have an end." That's fascinating. That's interesting. See how the Satanology is a little bit more robust. "Yea, sorrow will be led away with him. then will be filled the hands of the messenger who is in the highest place appointed. Yea, he will at once avenge them of their enemies. See, it's a messianic figure. For the heavenly one will arise from his kingly throne. Yea, he will go forth from his holy habitation with indignation and wrath on behalf of his sons, and the earth will tremble. Even to the end, to its ends shall it be shaken, and the high mountains will be made low. Yea, they will be shaken as enclosed valleys, they will fall. For God the Most High will search forth the Eternal One alone. In full view will he come to work vengeance on the nations. Yea, all their idols will he destroy. Then will you be happy, O Israel, and you will mount up above the necks and wings of an eagle. Yea, all things will be fulfilled, and God will raise you to the heights. Yea, he will fix you firmly in the heaven of the stars, in the place of their habitations, and you will behold from on high. Yea, you will see your enemies on the earth, and recognizing them, you will rejoice, and you will give thanks. Yea, you will confess your Creator. You know what that reminds me of? Acts 1. Is this now the time you're going to restore the fortunes to Israel? And Jesus is like, what? It reminds me of this. Great, great, I'm glad the Messiah has come. Now that you're resurrected, I mean, how can we be stopped now? He talks about what for 40 days in Acts chapter 1? 40 days, what does he talk to them about after his resurrection? The kingdom. And then after 40 days of explaining the kingdom and the way that the Spirit is going to be infused into the kingdom, their question is now the time you restore the kingdom to Israel? And my interpretation of Acts 1 verse 6 is, they asked a question that didn't make sense. So Jesus corrects it in verses 7 and 8. He says, no, that you, okay, I've only been talking about this for 3 years and 40 days, but no, yes, at the same time. But this is what they're working with. This is what it is that's saturating their context. Even after the Old Testament, we look at the documents. This is what they're expecting. So you see this same theme hammered in their minds. You are going to do these four things as the Davidic warrior king, even after the exile. But you do, after the exile, start to see a different something emphasized. We see a bit of a development of emphasis. It's not as if we can never find this in the Old Testament, because we can, but it's more retrospective. You see an emphasis in what's called the diarchic rule of the Messiah. If there's a Messiah figure in this intertestamental literature period, you see a development of the diarchic rule of the Messiah, which means the Messiah is both king and priest. There's a unique emphasis. Like I said, you can find it in the Old Testament. You can see it in Zechariah 6, even some sense Daniel 9 through Actions, Malachi 2. I mean, you can see it in the Old Testament. But the emphasis is pretty robust in the intertestamental period of the Messiah figure, if there is one, to be a king and priest. Here's my question. Why? Why does this become robustly emphasized in the intertestamental period?
Is it because there's so much debate over the high priest position?
What do you mean by that? Okay, so we're invoking something that I think is on the right track. What is the deal with the Zadok lineage? You guys just had your oral exam this week. What was the major issue with this? Let's go back. The two families that are warring, what was the issue? The right lineage. What family had the right lineage of Zadok? The Onaiads. And they were the ones, since they came from Zadok, the Onaiads should have been the high priestly family, yes? But what happens with, what's the other family? Tobiads. What happens? They eventually buy their way in through Menelaus. They were trying other ways through Hellenization. Didn't work until Jason backstabs his own family and then mistakenly appoints Menelaus to go take the tribute up to Antiochus. Right? Follow me? This is the reason why the oral exam's remembering is super important. Okay? It's not just an exercise in frivolity. It's actually tying into something. So all of a sudden then we see, when Menelaus becomes high priest, a loss of the Zadokite lineage, a loss of the true priestly lineage. That's one of the reasons why Psalm 110 is so fascinating. It doesn't actually take it back to Zadok. Where does it go back to? Melchizedek. The Hebrews connection. He is the priest in the lineage of Melchizedek. Who's Melchizedek? Great question. Who is it that receives a tribute from the patriarch of Israel as the king of Salem and priest of Salem that just kind of appears and leaves? Yes, there is even a lineage that's even greater than the Zadokite lineage. However, the high priest is kind of a big deal during the intertestamental period, because what does the high priest also become during this period? Because of the way the Persians interacted with the high priest. What does it become? Yeah, like almost a ruler, a political figure, right? Now, eventually, once the Hasmoneans regain religious independence, what happens with the high priest? What does it end up being combined with? The king, right? Matter of fact, what was the major issue with John Hyrcanus and the Hasidim that ends up fracturing the Hasidim, or the Jewish religiously fervent, becoming Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes? What was the issue? He claimed to be prophet, king, and high priest, right? And their big problem was he wasn't a part of the Zadokite lineage nor the Davidic lineage, right? So you have this major tension around the leading figure that is claiming to be both king and priest, but they don't have a lineage claim to either king or priest, and their actions betray that they are not God's king or priest. Does it shock you then that during that time period there is a strong emphasis on the restoration of king and priest through the messianic figure that is both? No. That shouldn't shock us. That's almost as what you would expect. Now, the whole point of this is, it's not as if in the Old Testament that doesn't exist. It just wasn't emphasized like it was whenever this was up for grabs. The intertestamental period doesn't create something new. It brings something that already existed to the forefront of the stage so that everybody can see how important it actually is. That this messianic figure needs to be a king priest figure. Is this making sense? Question, comment.
Did they ever try and add the threefold of the prophet? Moses talks about how there's a prophet like me. Is that ever part of the...
Definitely. It would have a prophetic function. I don't know if you ever actually see the language king, priest, prophet all saturated together. But the Mosaic, that's a little bit funny, but the prophecy of the prophet that will come after me, that's something that we do have a strong tradition that actually even appears in once we get into the Gospels. Because they even ask, what is it, in John chapter 8 or 10? But they even ask, is this the one, is this the prophet that we have been waiting for? So you see that it is at least a verbal passed on, and you see at times a prophetic figure, but I don't see it being wed together in the same emphasis as the retrospective John Hyrcanus. Because remember, John Hyrcanus is considered a priest, prophet, and king, but the prophet component was really revealed to us by Josephus. So that's a retrospective look back on John Hyrcanus. Other questions, comments? One of the things that also is quite fascinating, especially now, I'm kind of stopping for a moment with kind of the tracing of the timeline. We'll come back to it in a minute. But I'm also looking at, whenever you see Jews interact with Old Testament texts that seem to lend itself towards exactly what Jesus was, you see almost such a buy-in to the Davidic warrior king that crushes the enemies, that brings back the exiles, that establishes Yahweh on the throne on Zion, the exaltation of it. You see such an emphasis on that, that what they do is one of two things when they engage texts that would look more like Jesus. They either reinterpret those texts or they retranslate them. I mean, I find this really fascinating. In other words, this is almost, in a sense, emphasizing the tension the Jews would have felt with Jesus, but in a different way. So we have, let me trace these two, and then if you have a question of clarification, ask it. We have the Jewish interpretation, so Sanhedrin 98a. Now, technically, this is from the 200 to 500 CE. However, it's an oral tradition that probably goes back to the time of Christ, okay? But you have Sanhedrin, so you're talking, you're talking 200 to 500, the Amoraic period. It says, Rabbi Alexandri has said, Rabbi Yahshua, ben or son of Levi, has contrasted, lo, with the clouds of heaven came one like a son of man. What text is he quoting there? Daniel 7. That's a big one. He contrasts Daniel 7, lo, with clouds of heaven came one like a son of man, with lowly and riding on an ass, which comes from what Old Testament text? Yes, somebody was doing the zzz sound, that's right. Zechariah 9, that the lowly and riding on a donkey, which is one of the things that's invoked once Jesus is coming in on the triumphal entry. Now, his problem is this. He looks at him and he says, okay, you have the first one from Daniel 7 that seems to be talking about this really high, majestic, coming on the clouds type figure. Well, how can the same figure be coming also lowly and riding on an ass? How does that make any sense? His answer is to reinterpret it, to say this. If Israel has merits, so if Israel's doing good, then he comes with clouds of heaven. If Israel is struggling, disobedient, he will come lowly and riding on an ass. What did he do? He reinterpreted it, but what lens did he reinterpret it through? Is that question fair? Does that make sense? Who becomes the center of his interpretation? Israel. Instead of the figure. This is all contingent upon Israel, not the figure itself. In other words, we look at lowly and riding on an ass as something of referring to the humble kingship of Christ. There's a humility to it that also connects to Saul and some of the ways in which Old Testament kings would have been brought in. I get it. But there's also this humility component. But there, this doesn't say anything about the character of the Messiah. What this, in a sense, is commentating on is the character of Israel. Now, we look at it as just merely a way of rectifying something that seems conflating. I look at it also as a way of them wrestling with the fact that the Messiah's character is not up for grabs. He already will be this Davidic warrior king. The character expectations are in place. Therefore, the lowly riding on a donkey means nothing about him. It means something about Israel, which is a way of reinterpreting, to look at it and be like, let's just figure out, we can find a way around it. And we do that too. You know, kind of like sell everything and give it to the poor. We reinterpret that sucker so that we never have to engage that whatsoever. You know what I mean? We do that well. You also see, and hopefully you still have your handout, because I don't think I have this. No, I don't have this on the screen. But you also see at times in the Targumim, so you're talking the translation of the Old Testament text later, but the Targumim of Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 is about as clear of a text of Jesus' crucifixion as you can get. It's kind of startling, outside of maybe Psalm 22. But he was despised and forsaken of men, Isaiah 53:3, a man of torments and acquainted with infirmity. And like one from whom one hides his face, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our infirmities and carried our torments, but we considered him smitten with disease, stricken by God and afflicted. And he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed by our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes or with his wounds we are healed. Yeah? Notice, though, if you look at your handout on the right side, this is the retranslation of the same text. Then the glory of all the kingdoms will be for contempt and cease. Who is the object of contempt? Is it the messianic figure? No, who is it? The enemies, the kingdoms. They change the referent. They will be faint and mournful. The kingdoms, the enemies. Behold, as a man of sorrows and appointed for sicknesses, the kingdoms are a man of sorrows and appointed for sicknesses. And as when the face of the Shekinah was taken up from us, they are despised and not esteemed. In other words, the kingdoms of the earth will experience their own type of exile. You see what they're doing? Retranslated in Isaiah 53 so that the messianic figure can still be this Davidic warrior king that is crucifying the enemies, not being crucified. This picture of Jesus, what I'm wanting to emphasize, is that who Jesus was so startlingly different than what they were expecting, it shouldn't shock us they miss him completely. They were not looking for this. And when you find it in the Old Testament, they either reinterpret it or retranslate it in order for it to fit their expectations. I mean, I know I can keep just hammering this application point, but it's like, come on, where do we do this? We do this in our own context all the time. And the reason why it's so, the reason why I keep bringing it up is because it's so difficult to see where we are doing this. But that's important to know that it's difficult to see where we're doing this, because then it'll help you understand why it was so difficult for them to see Jesus. But we do this. We do this in the ways in which we subtly have the gospel serve us instead of us being able to serve the gospels. So I talk about this ad nauseum in my biblical justice class. But where, you know, even our evangelism smuggles in a gospel that serves you. Where Jesus is your personal Savior. Now, we say Lord and Savior, but we kind of do a wink and a nod of the head with Lord. It's really about being saved. That's really what we're talking about. And so people are like, that's right, Jesus saved me. And so then people come into the church and they have this weird relationship with the church when the church is asking them to do anything. Why? Because this is for me. It's about me getting saved and me getting out of hell and me getting away from all the things that are bothering me and hurting me. And I'm going, in our evangelism, one of the things we do not emphasize is, are you counting the cost? Jesus talks about that too. Because this means you lose everything. And I mean everything. You lose your dreams. You lose your rights. You lose what you fight for. And you gain a brand new way of looking at reality. You lose your right to be hateful and unforgiving. You lose everything. So you sure you want to commit? Instead, we're like, well, looks better on our bulletin numbers if we have another baptism. Let's hold off on the whole Lord thing and just push the Savior. And then we get upset at the people whenever they're complaining about carpet colors. What you win them with, you win them to. And you win them to a religion that serves them, then it shouldn't shock you whenever they get upset when they're not being served. We're doing this. How do we do it? We smuggle in our expectations of how Jesus serves us instead of figuring out how it is that we bow our knee to the King. We do this too. And it is so deeply embedded that even me challenging, matter of fact, I even call it me challenging the idol of salvation. I push it like that because I'm going, we worship salvation more than we even do the King. I mean, really, what is it that is making you gravitate towards Christ? What you get or who He is? Because I'm telling you, anything less than who He is idolatry. It's idolatry. It's not your salvation that you worship, it's Him. And if that ever gets messed up, then ultimately you will miss Him when He's staring you in the face. They did it, we do it, hopefully we'll all correct it. Love you guys, see you on the next day we have class.